I think that first, sort of starting off with the post-2015 conversation, I really do think we have an absolutely extraordinary opportunity right now to sort of to do a few things. One, to build on sort of a moment of global attention, thanks to the successes of the MDGs, thanks to sort of the way that the MDGs sort of rose up and were, certainly some achieved, but I think more just kind of caught global attention for development and created the idea of having a global agenda. So even though they might not have started out that way, and that wasn't their intention originally, that's where they ended up. And I think as a result, we're in a really good moment to sort of build on that momentum, both of the positives and of sort of the frustrations that the MDGs unearthed. Certainly a lot of lacking issues. So I think we really do sit at a good moment to be able to ask these questions. I think it enables us to really ask what compels transformative change, and to get a moment in time to stop and really ask that kind of question globally is a pretty phenomenal opportunity. It does mean that there are a lot of conflicting answers to that question, but it's ours to sort of our task to sort that out. And I think, you know, the way that we do that, the way that we sort that out is to, as much as possible, and I'll talk about this a little bit more, but is to try and get to what are the drivers of progress and sort of what are the root causes of the problems that we collectively believe to be problems. I think we have a lot of these answers already because we've been doing this kind of work for quite a long time. But I think we have to remind ourselves over and over and over again that our task is to try and have some sort of rubric for determining what really are sort of the drivers of progress and the converse, the causes of problems. So with that as sort of the starting point, I think you very rightly labeled the four issues that we were up until, I was going to say 4 o'clock in the morning, but that's not true, until 2 o'clock in the afternoon the next day, sort of struggling with. These are the most sort of politically contentious and tricky issues, and they will be until the end, I'm certain. So the one that I'll specifically talk about is right now is peace and governance, but obviously each of these is worthy of the same kind of attention. And these really, I think one of the reasons is not just because they're politically tricky, but also because these are some of the more transformative change that are going to be a bit more difficult to put into, to sort of get in all of our minds. So on the peace side of things, I think a lot of these statistics and this sort of data that the empirics that are part of this have been in the collective consciousness, I think, for probably some time, but certainly starting with the World Development Report in 2011. So the World Development Report in 2011 focused on peace and its impact on development. And many of these sort of these slides are from that. So when we look at extreme poverty, which will remain at the center of this agenda, so it's excellent that it is growing and that we're sort of understanding a bit more all of the different pieces that make up what one does to try and eradicate poverty, but that is very much going to be at the center. And if we look at where poverty is sitting now, we see that it's going to be sort of moving more and more to these tricky pockets that are hard to deal with, and that is often in conflict-affected countries. So by next year, over 50% of the world's poorest will live in conflict-affected countries. By 2030, so the end of the post-2015 agenda time period, 80% are projected to live in conflict-affected countries. So this is because as economic growth lifts people out of poverty, the places where it will remain are the ones where the easy economic growth pathways don't touch. And that tends to be regions that are fragile or more conflict affected. So this is to say, we know a lot of the statistics. We know that these things are deeply related, that it is very, very difficult to talk about development progress without talking about peace, without talking about the way that you deal with providing basic human services in places that are conflict affected. This is not going to be an easy conversation. People have been working on this for a long time and don't have easy answers, but they have been working on this for a long time and have answers. So it makes sense to sort of put our minds collectively, globally, on this issue. This is just another to say that countries with major violence had a 21-point higher poverty rate from 1981 to 2005. There are a few others I'm just going to run through very quickly. The average cost of civil conflict is equivalent to 30 years of GDP growth. So those two, that previous slide, go hand in hand with this. I put the next one here. The UNESCO estimates 28 plus million children are not in school in countries that are emerging from conflict. So if we are going to set speaking of integration, if we're going to set a goal that says we're going to get to universal primary education, we will not get there if we don't deal with issues of conflict and of peace. So that is one. Similarly, child mortality is twice as high. undernutrition is 3 times as likely in countries affected by severe violence. And speaking to the earlier question about universality, we can often bring these statistics out for the areas where the extreme poor are concentrated. But this is as much true in the United States as it is anywhere. We were on a team in the open working group with Canada and Israel. And at some point in the middle of this, when we were talking about peace and governance, we looked up the statistics about where we, the United States, ranked in relation to our teammates, as well as in relation to everybody else in the room on homicide rates. We're not in a great place. We are significantly worse than Canada and Israel on that. And I mean, this is not new knowledge, but it is something that we're going to have to wrestle with, because when you look at communities that are facing severe violence in the United States, those are the communities with the worst human development indicators. So this is a universal thing. And to the extent that we are going to sort of put things about violent death, things about justice systems on the table, all you have to do is open a newspaper to realize that we also are dealing with these kinds of issues. So I kind of want to, with the peace and governance stuff on the table, want to move very quickly to the question of focus. So the idea of having, we had conversations throughout the week last, obviously there was the climate summit, there were a number of climate events, there were a number of very excellent sort of questions about how you measure peace and governance on the table last week. There were some very good population sessions. So we have been talking about all of these things, sort of somewhat ad nauseum, but in a good way. The question is within that, and there are so many, I mean, as I sort of have said, there are so many really good arguments for why thousands of issues need to be part of this agenda. That's one reason we ended up with 169 targets and 17 goals. It's because this isn't an easy question. It's not like we weren't working very hard for a year and a half to get this focused. But every time we would talk about taking one thing off the table, a significant constituency, both within member states and in the NGO community, would come up and say, don't take that off the table. That's absolutely critical to what we're doing here. So we need to sort of collectively figure out what our criteria are for focus. And I think if I had to pick one thing, the one big idea that wasn't on the table last week, it was focus. It was figuring out how to prioritize among the many, many things, all of which are important. Our goal isn't to figure out which aren't important. Our goal is to figure out either how to integrate or sort of consolidate ideas to bring them together and kind of collectively get to action so that we get fewer ideas so our minds can actually conceive of how to do this. Or it's to figure out what we're most effective at. And so I think the kind of criteria were certainly put forward in RealPlus20. We had limited in number, universally relevant, action-oriented, easy to communicate, as Etiana put on the board earlier. But then we also have to sort of ask ourselves, what is achievable? What is achievable and aspirational? What is measurable? And some of the things don't necessarily need to be as we set out, but we have to have a game plan to figure out how to measure them by the end. And then also sort of, if we do a thorough analysis of the sort of evidence base of it, what do we end up with as the answers for what we can actually affect change on? So there are a number of things that are critical issues. If you look at the Open Working Group's output, and it's really great evening reading, there are some really focused, excellent indicators. And then there are a number that you couldn't, if you thought about how to implement them, if you thought about how to actually do something with them, you would have nothing. Because you take something that started out in the MDGs is extremely effective, the HIV/AIDS, TB, and malaria goal. In this round, we kept that and sort of end the epidemics of, and had a pretty good and robust discussion about that. But then in the end, in the 11th and the 11 and a half hour, it added and other communicable diseases. So now we are left with a target that literally takes on every disease that the world faces. We, as a community, both civil society and government and private sector, know how to do better than that. And we have to hold ourselves to be more precise than that, to be more rigorous in how we set our own priorities. And that probably means saying to ourselves, this is an issue that matters deeply to me and deeply to my organization, and it isn't something that we can actually do in this period of time. Or it's something that shouldn't be on governments to do. We should highlight that as something that should be on X number of other organizations to do. We have to ask those questions about who are the right actors and how do we determine an agenda that's based on that, and how do we know that not putting something in this agenda doesn't mean we don't care about it. We have to be able to sort of know that we can have another system or a system that's complementary to this to flag critical issues without needing to have them be part of this. So this is on us as well. I mean, we're having this struggle internally nonstop. We have had it for the last year and a half, and we'll keep having it, and that's our responsibility too. But it's sort of all of our responsibilities too, sort of as a globe, to kind of get to a point where we can make hard decisions. So one other thing I wanted to raise that I thought was on the table last week, that both was and wasn't on the table last week, that I actually think is probably the crux of all of this, or at least pretty close to it, is the concept of multilateralism. So if you watch the president's speech, he had the climate speech and then also his regular General Assembly speech, watch them both, but the General Assembly one is the one I'm referring to. So he did something very, I think, in all of it. He was talking a lot about foreign terrorist fighters, about ISIL, about all sorts of issues that thankfully are tricky enough that we don't have to deal with them in this agenda. he talked about climate, he talked about the development agenda, and in each of them, what the speech marked was a turn to multilateralism, was a turn to a recognition that you can't achieve any of these complex things without it being about cooperation. And I think some of that is very obvious, but I think it's also sort of fundamental to the success of this, because it is about bringing in the private sector. It is about bringing in civil society and saying there's a role for all of us in this pathway towards this goal, and we have to define what those roles are, and we have to be okay working out the really tricky parts of multilateralism in order to get there. And I think the last thing I'll say is just that, in addition to just saying, yeah, multilateralism is great, I mean, that's sort of a part of this whole orientation of talking about post-2015 here, it's also our ability to get to success on this is going to test multilateralism. I think this was the UN's kind of big ticket item of success outside of the Security Council. On the development agenda, the MDGs were one of the big ticket UN items. If we can't do this well in the next year and a half and then the 15 years that follow, we will be potentially, I mean, this sounds sort of alarmist, we will potentially be calling into question what the UN is all about and what multilateralism is all about in the first place. So we sort of all are compelled to have to ask these tough questions, and then to figure out a way, if our answer is different than somebody else's, to work that out. Because if we don't, it really does, I think, call into question a lot of what we're even here for.